Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Oh, hi, everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. We've been off for a little while, but we're back. Hi, Bob. What's going on?
Well, Matt, nobody cares what's going on with me because you're a bit of a celebrity these days. I see you're everywhere telling your story of your great travels and the hijinks that ensued.
Yes. Yeah, we were in South Africa, and about 4, 5, maybe 6 days in, this thing called Omicron happened, and I thought it was someone who was joining up with Starscreen to fight Optimus Prime, and apparently it's this new variant, and at first it was this thing that was exploding across South Africa, and then we learned that might not exactly be true, but then that certainly changed our trip a little bit. The main thing I can say is that it was funny, people were asking, are you guys safe? And we felt completely safe in South Africa, just in terms of the rules, the masks and everything. Everything was very orderly, and where we were, there was no danger. The main issue was it was just hard to get home because America soon closed the borders. So we bought tickets for a new flight home from Cape Town to Newark back to Toronto, and then that got canceled. And so what happened was, to fly home, there was only one airport, Frankfurt. We could only go Cape Town to Frankfurt, Frankfurt to Toronto. So then it just, you know, the difficulty is, can you make the flight? Will you be able to make the flight? Will they change the rules? Oh, you need a PCR test. Oh, wait, now we need one at the Frankfurt airport. But if we get one at the Frankfurt airport, we got to get the results back. So then will we make our, you know, our next flight from Frankfurt to Toronto? And if we miss it, when's the next flight? And it's just, and then, oh, wait, it's not 72 hours. Now it has to be within 48 hours. So that was really the source of the stress and anxiety.
So are you on your own while all this is happening?
No, I was with Amy and her twin sister, Kristen.
But the three of you.
Very little help.
Yeah, that's what I really want to know, because obviously as a Canadian national trying to get home, nobody expects South Africa to suddenly have this variant, and nobody expects all the borders to close as quickly as they did. So quite unforeseen. Are you like, what was it like trying to figure out what your options are?
It was frustrating because you're trying to call airlines, airports, and you know, you're going to be on hold and you're not going to get a lot of help. And the consulate didn't really provide very much at all. Most of the information you could find online, you know, they provided a couple snippets here or there, but that was really about it. And my main criticism with the consulate is not that they didn't immediately send a private jet to whisk us home, but it's they didn't have basic information about here's where you go for a PCR test. Like, I'll tell you, Bob, the biggest thing that would have helped us is they have told us there is two different places at the Cape Town airport to get a PCR test, including one where you get the result in 2 hours, because that gives you the flexibility to book almost any flight knowing, oh, okay, I can get my PCR test and they'll let me on the plane. And I had to find that out by, I just went to the airport super early one morning and wandered around until I found all the different resources. If the consulate had just had that, which is the most bare minimum, that would have provided just so much help for any Canadian stranded in South Africa.
This is the nightmare scenario for people. I mean, apart from getting sick, and you're not sick, and we're all happy about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the reasons why people, I hear a lot of families that I talk to around Charlotte School either had vacations planned or were planning vacations. And since this happened, people are very reluctant to actually go through with it because they don't want to get stranded anywhere. And they also don't want it to be super hard to do it because it's not much of a vacation if you're dealing with a ton of uncertainty or a ton of protocols. I guess what I'm asking here is, was it worth it?
Yes, it was 100% worth it. Even like for me, where my stress and anxiety would come right before going to bed and then right waking up in the morning, you know, you get that little twisting of the gut. But then we still did everything we were going to do on the trip. See all of Cape Town, see the Garden Route, coastal towns, many little safari, visit a bunch of Amy's friends who she worked with on a cruise ship. and then 4 days touring in Stellenbosch, which is as beautiful a wine region as any I've been, and I'll include France and Italy. So no, it definitely was worth it. Like, we knew we'd get home. We never feared for our lives in terms of COVID. It was just the anxiety of, you know, what is our plan? And what I've realized is that human beings, we're very adaptable. You know, we can change on a, you know, like look at everyone now adjusting to Zoom and this and that and the other thing. But the one thing I think humans have the hardest time, I know I do, is uncertainty, is the unknown. We can adjust when you give us a parameter, is here is the new set of circumstances that you've got to live your life by. Fine. But the unknown, that's what sort of, I think, scares all of us. Like, if you had told us, Bob, okay, guys, you're going to be here for 2 extra weeks, but you'll be able to get home on December 18th. Okay, it's going to be a lot more money, and it's going to mean change to our lifestyle. But now we know what the final end thing is going to be. Not having that, that's the source of stress.
Such a great observation. You're right. You can adjust to almost any bad news.
Yeah.
But you have to have something to adjust to, or else, like, that's where the anxiety really kicks in, is the not knowing.
Yeah.
Okay, so apart from your brilliant realization about human nature, now you're in a quarantine hotel. So tell me what happens. You get home from Frankfurt, the plane lands in Pearson. What happens next?
It was about, I would say, 3 hours after the plane landed, maybe a little bit longer before we got to the COVID hotel. I should say quarantine, not COVID. It's the quarantine hotel.
Sorry to interrupt you, but how did they get you there? Did you have to be tested before you could, you know, enter the pop?
Oh, yeah.
Like, do they sequester you? Do you have to go right? Like, how does that work?
So after you pass through customs, once you tell them we're from the deadly land of South Africa, which is ridiculous, by the way, we can get into that. It's not like South Africa. I think in the end, the first person who got Omicron was from like Belgium or something. Anyway, So you have to, after you go through that, you get in this line and you explain to the person, you show them your negative COVID test. You show them your arrive cam, that you've completed your arrive cam stuff. Then you sit and wait for about another 25, 30 minutes until someone explains to you, here's what's going to happen. You're going to go to the quarantine hotel and here are your legal rights and do you understand it and all that. Then you get another PCR test. So this is PCR test number 3, 4 in the last 96 hours. Then you and a whole bunch of other frazzled adults. I was not frazzled. I just sat quietly. But you could definitely sense, you know me, when things are bad, I just get quiet and I just go inward. But yeah. you could sense the adults who are not happy. And I get it. You've been flying for 20 plus hours. But now we're waiting for the shuttle bus to take us to the hotel. That was another 30 minutes or so. And those sort of 30 minutes, that's not a fast 30 minutes. You know, like you see your favorite episode of The Simpsons, and you're like, wow, 30 minutes flew by. This is the opposite. And then the shuttle bus that picked us up, and this was Monday night. It was dark. It was windy. It was a school bus, Bob. It was old school, yellow, no seatbelt school bus that picked us up.
Get out.
Nope.
So, like, there were no seatbelts on the seats kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yep. That kind.
Wow. Nothing yes. But the best for our people.
Nope. So then we all get on the school bus, and it's funny. Like, you can tell at this point it's full Lord of the Flies. Everyone is rushing to get on the bus and to be near the front. And Amy, Christy, and I, we're like, no, whatever. And, of course, the girls being the girls, they're helping the nurse get all the luggage on the bus. And we're like, no, we're not going to do this shoving thing that, you know, some people were doing. There was also one couple where the guy had diabetes and, you know, he was all that time waiting. His insecurity would be at a level I could never understand. So then you have that stress. And so we drive to the hotel, which is not far. It's like on like Dixon Road and whatever. And we're sitting now at the side of a hotel with a little side white door, which is where we're going to go in. And we're now sitting there for another 25 minutes and it's dark and windy. And, you know, the door's never opening. And eventually when it does, it's like people in basically like hazmat suits. Like, Bob, I felt like the outbreak monkey after I murdered Patrick Dempsey. Like, it was like, Like the full we face, felt like we were like, radio.
Was it the space?
Yes.
Like the full.
Oh, yeah. All of it. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm like, wait a minute. We're safer than almost anyone else. Do you have any negative tests we've gotten over the last couple of days?
I was about to say, was it 3 or 4 tests now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I literally lost count. My nostrils, you know, they're now, I can handle any sort of abuse.
You're going to look like a cocaine addict. You're going to be walking around with these, like, bloody nostrils.
I know.
You're going to look like Al Pacino in the final reel of Scarface.
Yeah, I know. Without the joy of cocaine, which I hear is delightful, and then bad. Never get hooked on your own stuff is what I learned. So then they take you in like one couple at a time, and a couple people eventually just got off the bus because, again, at least one was about diabetes. I'm not sure about others, and I don't know if I saw them again. I think some people just got an Uber and left. Well, that's gonna be a heavy fine. Eventually, we get into the hotel, and they give us our room, and you cannot leave the room. You cannot go in the hallway. You cannot do anything. The rooms themselves were fine. Like, I'd like to do the story of like Fyre Festival with the food, or, you know, we didn't have that. The room was fine. The food was fine. But the problem was, again, the same theme, Bob, about uncertainty. We get our COVID test back negative. Between then and when we're allowed to leave, it was another 24 plus hours. And now you're wondering again, what's the plan? And you would call down and they said, we don't know. Wait for someone to release you. And the frustration was, wait a minute. We've got another negative PCR test. We've already explained what our quarantine plan is. You know our address. You know where we're going to be. You know that we have set up for food to be delivered. Why are we still here? And again, lack of transparency, lack of conversation, lack of information. That's what was the source of stress.
Okay. So how far, first of all, are you home now?
Yes, I am home now.
Okay. So the kinds of calls you're talking about, how far into staying at the hotel is this? Like, how many days did you wind up staying there?
We stayed just under 3 days, but we were there for, I think, like 26, 28 hours from when we got our negative PCR test.
And the food, do they basically, you tell them, is it like room service? Just you tell them what you want and they drop it off at the door kind of thing?
No. You specify before vegetarian or non-vegetarian, and they deliver 3 meals a day. And the food is fine.
So you don't get to ask. It's like an airplane where you can get the chicken or the fish kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But the weird thing is, it's like, you know, Amy was calling and emailing different government organizations to say, you know, is there somewhere we can get more information? And some of the officials were like, wait a minute, you don't need to be there. And that made it even worse. It's like, wait a minute, we're from some officials. We're not supposed to be there. And we're, you know, and so that just, you know, exasperated a little bit of the stress and the what the hell is going on, you know. So there was that. But yeah, like the food in the room was fine. The TV, you know, lots of channels. But wow, I got to tell you, Bob, there's a lot of strange things on like A&E and Showtime and Slice and Vision and W Network. It's wild out there.
There's a lot of options. Not all of them make sense. So yeah. When they called you to release you, basically it's just the phone rings and you get the tap on the shoulder and you're back on the ice kind of thing?
Yep. Yep, that's exactly it. And
what happens for you now? Like, are you free to walk around? Do you have to stay in your house now? Like, how does the next, say, 10 to 14 days look for you and Amy and Christy?
Between now and the 19th, like midnight or 11:59 p.m. on December 19th, we are here at our home. We're not allowed to leave.
Okay, so this may seem stupid, and forgive me if I don't get it, but you've had about 7 negative tests now.
You know what? Let's go. I'm gonna lowball it because, you know, I like to try to avoid hyperbole. Let's go with 4.5 to 5.
Okay. Do we feel after 4.5 to 5, there are probably no false negatives and you probably don't have the variant?
Yeah, I could tell you right now, Bob, like one of Amy's, like Amy has a friend who got COVID feeling fine. Like, and this is like in Coburg or some small town, you know, and when I hear that, I realize that we, like me and Amy and Christy, we're safer than most everyone else. All we've had is negative tests. All we've had is been surrounded by, either people wearing hazmat suits or people that have also had multiple negative tests. And,
I kind of feel like I want to go stay at your place. Like, it's now the embassy of safety.
Oh, yeah. And it's not, and by the way, it's not like what we were staying in South Africa was some crazy hotbed of it. Like we were in Cape Town. We weren't in busy, crazy, busy areas. And everyone wears masks outdoors there far more than North America. And everywhere you go to enter, they spray your hands. And we were in Stellenbosch, and we'll talk about that, in like wine country. And so we're in small towns and, you know, and again, I'm not saying this to be bitter, like, let me out, let me be free. Because I'm fine. But yeah, like I feel zero level of danger to my fellow man.
Did you walk out of this with a different impression of how this is being managed than the one you might have had when you got on the plane to South Africa?
I mean, it certainly hits home the level of inefficiency and the level of I don't think they know what they're doing. And by the way, let me say this, and I've tried, I mean this. This, like any negativity, it's not towards the staff at the hotel or the nurses. And I know this is all just, this is about the infrastructure setup that seems really slow. Also, it feels like South Africa is getting punished. If we had flown home from, like one of our original trip ideas was actually going to be Chile. If we had done that trip, we wouldn't have been going through all this rigmarole. But I bet there's Omicron cases there, and there's an Omicron case from someone in Southern Ontario who never traveled. So I feel like my bigger picture thing is our inefficiency, and I get it, every country has it, but also it feels like South Africa is being unfairly punished. And I try to say that, but you know, understanding every country is trying to be safe and we're adjusting on the fly, but wow. Closing everything down in South Africa, not like a knee-jerk reaction.
So let's step away from the COVID stuff for a second. Yeah. Like, let's hear about South Africa, because I've never been, but I think like a lot of people, I've always been curious about it because people describe it as like the most beautiful place on earth.
Like Cape Town, you look in one direction, you get oceans. You look in the other, you get these gorgeous mountains. It's stunning. It is beautiful. The people there are like, Canadians are damn nice. We don't rank up like compared to South Africa. We're mean. Like just everyone was super nice, from cabs to Uber to everyone in hotels to just asking for help on the street. It's a gorgeous, beautiful country. I would recommend it to everything. There's 1,000 different things to do. We feel bad because their tourism industry, which is starting now, it's their summer. It's gonna take a massive hit. And the funny thing is everywhere we went, I would always ask, when was the last time you saw a Canadian? And so many times they're like, we haven't seen you guys in years.
You saw a giraffe.
Yeah, we saw many giraffes. And the safari was a mini one. And this is going to sound douchey, but like Amy and Christy, because they go to Africa a lot for their charity, for their school in Mombasa, Kenya, they've been on plenty of safaris. I was lucky enough in grade 8 to go on a pretty crazy one myself. So we didn't want to spend the money on a full day night thing. We just wanted a couple hours in the Jeep, seeing, you know, rhinos and hippos and giraffes and elephants. So we got to do that. And that was a ton of fun.
Percentage wise, or however you want, fractions, percentage, pie chart, whatever. What percentage of time were you drunk?
Percentage of time drunk?
Not drunk, just buzz. Oh, like
buzz. Okay.
Like some wine flowing through the system.
I would say, because also there is still a curfew there, even before Omicron, there was still a curfew by midnight that, you know, we'd be out during the day and then around 10 o'clock or so at night, we'd be back in our room and like part of the trip is to sample and just to expand my palate of South African wines. So I say on a lot of nights, we'd be sitting at this cool Airbnb watching Christmas movies and drinking wine. And so I'd say, you know, most nights there was a nice little slight buzz. I would say only one night where it's like, oh, we got at it.
Okay, so everybody, I'm going to ask Matt for his top 3 South African wine recommendations in just a moment. So if you want to hear that, grab a pencil, grab some paper, get yourself together. In 1 minute, we'll start that. But now the most important question, Matt, now that we know you're not going to die. By the way, Jeff Pollock sent me a text. He was worried about you. And I and then I reached out to you because I wasn't. And but on his behalf, I sent you a text. You got back to me promptly. And Jeff was happy that you were okay. And I was actually kind of ashamed that I'd thought so little about it. So everybody's got a minute to get their stuff to write down your recommendations. Top three meals, though. Top three most delicious things you ate.
Ooh, okay. One that might not have been the best meal, but I'll remember it. Amy had friends, as I mentioned, that she was on a cruise ship with. So we went to this really cool, local bar restaurant in, say it out loud, Amy, Cape de Cuba. And it was overlooking the ocean, and I had fish and chips. It was just really yummy fish and chips. And it was just wonderful watching Amy and her friends all get caught up and drinking sparkling wine with it, or as they call it, Cap Classique. So I would say that was one. The other, Ken Forrester, this beautiful winemaker, very famous South African winemaker. We did these private tours through our 4 days in Stellenbosch. He bought us lunch and just like, oh, here, try this tuna. Try this duck. Try this crazy risotto with all these wines. That would be a second one. And then the third one, I'm going to go Rustin Verde. People eat a lot of steak at lunch, Bob. And this like peppercorn steak with like big fries and stuff. I would put that one as well. Oh, and a shout out to the restaurant Brass Bell. Really, really nice and fun as well.
I forgot to ask, but is it shark season?
We didn't do the shark cage. Amy and Christy had done it before. And Bob, because they did it before when they were much, much younger and they lost the bet at a bar when they were like 25. It was a different time. I didn't go in the shark. I didn't go in the shark cage, Bob, because in the words of Quint, cage goes in the water, sharks in the water, you go in the water. I forget the song he was singing. So, yeah.
Well, and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies.
Yeah. So, and also, the water was cold. Like, trust me, Bob, you know me, I'm a water freak. Yeah. We tried many times to go in the Indian Ocean. I could get up to my upper knee, and that was about it.
I don't think I would go in the cage, mostly because I don't want to participate in the stupidity of creating a shark industry, like a shark economy. I don't think you want sharks to get used to people, and they're always chumming water to get, you know, sharks to show up. Yeah. And like none of it, it just seems like here's a perfectly good thing. Let's let sleeping sharks lie.
Yeah.
If they don't want to eat people, great. Yeah. They don't want to be eaten.
Yeah. So we had no interest in that. Also some great seafood meals in like the little small towns as well, which we need to talk about prawns in a moment, but we'll get there later. But
yes,
but
let's get there later. Let's get there now. Because eventually we'll start talking sports, although we're 25 minutes in. So maybe we won't. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe we won't. Raptors game last night. Not so good. The one funny thing I want to warn North Americans about when you go abroad, especially, you know, nations like South Africa, places that really are around water. If you think prawns and shrimp are the same, they're very close. Prawn is a commitment. Prawn is more extreme. You can say you're a shrimp lover, but you better be ready when you wade into the waters of prawns because you get the antlers on their head and the eyeballs and the face.
It's the tentacles.
It's the tentacles. Oh, yeah. Yeah, like you better be prepared. And I knew that ahead of time, but I got some pretty aggressive prawns. I loved it. Amy and Christy, not so hot about it. But yeah, Bob, I'm sure you can agree. For everyone who says, oh, yeah, I love shrimp. As long, let's see you get through the prawns first.
Well, people think shrimp, it's like the shrimp that they get in their pad thai, which is all cleaned and cooked up. Prawns, if you're going to eat prawns, and I love prawns, but I have to sum it up the East Coast in me, where you just have total engagement with something in a shell. And you have to abandon the idea that this is a delicate thing. Like, it's an animal. It's basically like the shell is the carrying case. It's still got the head and the eyeballs. Yeah. Like, you're eye to eye with your food. You got to be okay with that.
Yes.
If you're going to enjoy a good prawn. The thing is, though, it soaks up all the good sauce. So
I know.
If you're willing to do it, the payoff is there. But for a lot of people, they can't eat that stuff because it looks like the animal that it was. There's just too much connection to it.
Yeah, and you better be fine with the word membrane. I don't know exactly what it is, but you better be okay with membrane. You're going to need a separate plate to put all the accoutrement, and I mean by that again the eyes, the face. But yeah, so just a little PSA for everyone. It's delicious. It's a little bit of work, and emotionally you're going to have to adjust.
Yeah, it's the eyes. It's the eyes and the tentacles for sure.
Yep. Yep.
All right. So we've been teasing it, Matt. You are a sommelier. You're the sports sommelier. We love that about you. You were in South Africa. I don't know jack about wine, but I do know apparently South Africa has a lot of good ones. What were your top three wine experiences? And I'm writing these down because if I can get them at the LCBO, maybe I'll do this for Christmas.
Okay. So, I'm going to start with just a general philosophy.
Okay.
And that is, I didn't realize just how much South Africa was about Cabernet Sauvignon.
Oh, like I know who knew?
Well, I knew, but more in it like Bordeaux blend, where it's used with other grapes. And I know they're big on Syrahs and things like that. But my message to people is that if you like Napa Cabernet, but you can't, you know, Napa Cab can be so expensive, and a lot of the ones that are $18 have got a lot of sugar and chemicals. Try different South African Cabernet Sauvignons. You can find wonderful ones from $15 to $22 that I guarantee you are better made and cleaner and more natural versions of that grape than what you're going to get in California. So that is my first tip for everyone out there. There's a winery called Speer, but it's spelled like S-P-E-I-R. I've never seen a winery that does so much legitimate charity work or does so much stuff to empower young people and artists. And they do things like they buy trees off of farmers, and then they grow them, and then they sell the trees, and the money they make from it, they give back to the communities. Now, this place is owned by a fairly wealthy family, but Lord, the amount of stuff they do. So, find their wines, and you're going to be supporting a lot of good people. Hamilton Russell, their Pinot Noir, it's going to cost you $50. So that's expensive, but it is going to taste like $100 Burgundy. Rustenburg, another one. Rustenberg.
Okay, Rustenberg. Gotcha.
Another one that's rust, never word, E-N. Next word, V-E-R-D-E. In incredible wines. Glen Ellie. And again, even if you misspell it by a letter, if you go to South African section, you'll find it. One final one, because I'm giving a ton, and I'll tweet out more. Conde, C-O-N-D-E. Other words, Stark. Oh, my God, a gorgeous place. And there's Syrah as well. Woo! Is good. But my final overall message: the moment they open up the borders and the moment people are comfortable, go to South Africa. And more importantly, go to Stellenbosch, because Bob, these places are giant and big and opulent, but at the same time, zero pretense. And a lot of them you can go in for free, or if you have to pay for a tasting, it is super cheap. For wine tourism, very few places in the world do it better than Stellenbosch.
Matt, we hit the 30-minute mark. It's half of our pod. I feel like this is the perfect time to move on. We're all glad you're safe, especially Jeff Pollock, who actually cared. And it's an interesting story that you've been booked on CTV News, and I see that you and Duthie talked, you know, so I'm glad to see that the podcast that had your name on it was like the ninth place you told the story.
Well, you know, Bob, I might have done it sooner if I knew my podcast host cared about me.
That's a great point. Okay, I got a question for you. And I can catch you up on anything in sports if you have any questions for me. But I have a question for you, because I was thinking about this the other day. The Leafs have been on a super heater lately.
Yep.
And the city is not on fire the way you would expect, even if this was 2 years ago, because, you know, all the things. We're waiting for the playoffs. We all know it. I have been a Leafs fan, and sometimes fanatic, for 45 years. And I'm kind of wait and see right now. I'm not obsessed with watching every period. I see they're doing well. I'm keeping tabs on it. I'm enjoying games here and there, but not obsessively the way I would normally. Am I a bandwagon jumper if I have been a fan my whole life, but I'm waiting and seeing this year to see if it's safe to jump back on? Does that make me a bandwagon jumper?
Absolutely not. It makes you part of, I don't want to say the majority, but it could be at least 51%. No, this... You know the answer, Bob. It's the product of what happened the last time against Boston, where they're up 3-2, or against Columbus, when they looked lifeless offensively for so much of it. And, of course, what happened in Montreal. Now, this is just, you know what this is, Bob, is that you go to adopt a rescue dog, and you're the nicest, most wonderful family, but that dog is still going to flinch when you go to pet it early on. And that's kind of what a lot of Leaf fans are. And it's a shame because it has been a hell of a heater. I have been doing my best to follow what's going on, but no one is going to be able to fully enjoy this Leaf, or not everyone, but a lot of people won't be able to enjoy this Leaf season the way they should if you just treated it in a vacuum.
It does seem a shame, doesn't it? It reminds me, I remember once
it does.
Once when I was young, I had an on again, off again relationship with this one girl. And then finally, it was just off. You know what I mean? Like, and I could not get it back on again, no matter how hard I tried. And I kind of feel that way. Like, you cross this threshold where, you know, maybe in being the Leafs fan, where you say, you know what, one day this team's going to lose my interest. You know, they're going to push me too far. And then this heater happened, and I didn't all of a sudden, like, start watching everything like a salivating dog. And I thought, maybe it's actually happened. Maybe the thing that for all of these years, through the Ballard years, through the salute gates, through the everything, I always thought, you know, one day they're going to push me too far. And I thought, is this that day? Did I get pushed too far? I don't think so. But I bet you a lot of people are wondering, why am I not more excited? And it's not intellectual. It's more of on a gut level where you're like, no, they got to win me back a little bit. They got to win me back.
And the shame of it, and the thing is, we were saying this the day after that series against Montreal. Yeah. I've been, you know, saying this on air all the time. The biggest shame of them losing, it was not them, they're not going to win a cup, because who knows if they would have won the cup anyway if they beat Montreal. It's what it was going to do to this year. Like, think about it. The Leafs, and maybe it won't happen because, you know, the injury to Marner and, you know, and things like that. But the Leafs could have one of their greatest regular seasons ever, and we're not going to care. We're not going to care to the extent we should.
You know who I feel badly for in all this? Jack Campbell.
Mm. Yeah.
He's playing great. And as the season started, I can't say that I was skeptical that he would be this good, but I was certainly cautious. Because, you know, more often than not, goalies are just so hard to predict. And there was more reason to believe that he would be fine but not great than there were to think he would be great. It was kind of hopeful optimism to think he'd be great. And he has been. And in any other year, like, I'm thinking about when I was a kid and, like, you know, there was this goaltender named Yuri Sirov, and he was hot for like an afternoon. And the next day, all the kids, like, we were pretending to be Yuri Sirov in net. My buddy actually, like, wrote Sirov on his, like, blocker that he made out of, you know, cardboard. And that's the way we would normally react to this. But I kind of feel like this thing that we've been starving for, a great goalie, you know, someone that you can really, you know, believe in. And we've kind of checked out on it. Maybe in a weird way, it's a good thing, you know, because he's not going to get that obsessive focus that you would ordinarily get. But it feels like Matthews is Matthews. The league loves him. Marner has his ups and downs, but everybody knows he's great. Blah, 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 blah. But Jack Campbell is the revelation here. He's getting ripped off by the malaise that the Leafs have inherited.
Oh, yeah. It's a great point. He's been the most important player for this Leafs team up to this moment. This is the best goaltending we've had. Like, since he started last year, this is the best run of goaltending we've had since Cujo, since Belfour.
Since Belfour.
This has been, you know, it's been incredible. And you're right. Like, we're enjoying it. We're giving him praise. But if the Leafs had won two rounds in the playoffs and then, say, lost to Colorado or Vegas or something, we would be treating this far. We'd be throwing even more roses and flowers his way.
Maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah,
maybe it's a good thing because there isn't that crazy pressure cooker vibe in quite the same way you get. It's a bit of a drag for all of us because it is kind of fun just to, like, as you've often said, Matt, like, being a fan is not about being logical. It's about being passionate. And, you know, it'd be fun to have the, you know, what's more likely to, you know, that Matthews will be the MVP or that Campbell will be the Vezina winner. I mean, that's the fun stuff, you know, but we're not really doing it. By the way, you know what's interesting? how we always forget, you, me, everybody, when somebody comes off of an injury and surgery, they don't wind up in the lineup fully prepared to take off. It takes time. Like Matthews is now scoring at a crazy rate. I think it's like 10 goals in 7 games or 7 goals, whatever it is. He's just scoring at a crazy rate because he's healed. And now he's back up to speed after missing training camp and, you know, rehabbing. And Pascal Siakam looks really, really good. But it's like, I don't know what happened, but the instant analysis has made people lose all sense of what the human body actually does when recovering from injury.
You know what we need here, Bob?
No.
I won't get this exactly right because I don't play a lot of video games. But you know, sometimes in video games, when your character is hurt, you know, they might flash a little red, or their body language might be a little off. Or like if you're playing some shooting game and you're hurt, and you know, there'll be something on the screen that'll be blinking, health low, or you know, I got 4 hit points left.
Or if I could take this, like you've probably never played Sims. Have you played Sims before?
No.
They're avatars that are supposed to be like real people and you run their lives. And my daughter plays this. And when they have to go to the bathroom, they get sad. And then eventually they like pee themselves. And then they get even sadder. And you can see there's sadness avatars happening. So, you know, Matthews had to pee. And they finally got him to the bathroom, and now he's okay.
Yeah, like imagine if with Matthews, you saw the first couple of games, there was a yellow, not red, but a little yellow light glowing from his wrist or something, and something similar for Siakam or just any guy hurt. So you watch, because when you watch Siakam or Austin Matthews when they first walk onto the ice or the court, like, hey, there's that guy. And he looks like the guy that I remember when he was making an all-star team or whatever. But if he had the little glowing light, at least it would be a visual cue that, oh yeah, they're not 100% yet.
Or Scotty Barnes, like, well, let's tilt back to the Raptors for a second, because, you know, I don't want to say they're more interesting than the Leafs. The Leafs are kind of fun right now, but yeah, maybe they are more interesting because there's more open questions with the Raptors. So Siakam comes back, and you made the point, totally valid, that maybe it's time to move him because he duplicates Scotty Barnes' skill set, and he might get in the way of Scotty's development. And after Siakam comes back, you know, Scotty's numbers start to drop a little bit. And all of a sudden, Evan Mobley's at the top of all the rookie lists, you know, even though he's hurt, because Scotty's numbers are dropping a little bit. And I feel like we also need, like, that blinking yellow light there, too, where it's like, well, he's just taking less shots. And in order for his development to be good, like, he doesn't need to be awesome every night. He needs to learn how to play on a team and do all kinds of things. And it made me think about the instant analysis about how, like, we went from Scotty Barnes is going to be, like, the next Kawhi Leonard. And then he cools off, and it's like, oh, maybe he's not as great as he thought we were. And it's like, he's a freaking rookie. Like, he's, like, 20, 25 games into his first year. We've already had 3 different versions of what his whole career is going to look like that people have bought into. Like, instant analysis, like, it's kind of fun. But I also feel like we're at a ludicrous pace now where we literally can take a sample of 2 or 3 games and decide what someone's whole career is going to be like.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Bob, it's 24 hours. We got to fill that time. Everyone loves instant analysis.
Yeah, I blame you because you're part of that media, the sensational gotcha media with your gotcha questions.
You know what's funny? I see sometimes that, you know, the really loud media, sports media in Canada and the States and the crazy proclamations. And part of me is jealous because I want to do that role, you know, just be that crazy hot take guy. And I just can never conjure it up. You know, like I have my things and here and there, but yeah, I could just never go to that full nuts level.
The Raptors Twitter, I love. They've gone a little crazy over Scotty Barnes. You kind of want to pump the brakes just a little, like, let's not anoint him NBA champion just yet. The team isn't even 500. But I want to go back to this idea of Siakam and Barnes, though. Because Brian Windhorst went on Overdrive, and he talked about how important, like, the primary goal of the Raptors now is whatever's good for Scotty. And I wouldn't necessarily have gone that far, but I don't find him to be a hot take guy. Not in the way like a Stephen A. Smith is. I think he's more measured in his approach. And it got me to thinking about what you said, which is they just have to develop Scotty. Do you feel more committed to that opinion now that maybe Siakam is dealable because he might get in the way of that development?
Yeah, my first focus, I think, is on Scotty. And maybe this is sort of the conservative part of me when it comes to sports, where the Siakam story is incredible, but it's not as repeatable as the, you know, young phenom in college, top five pick. Well, wait a minute, he's actually a better shooter than maybe we thought. And you have Durant and Jason Kidd, you know, going out of their way to praise him. Those are usually the markers on the journey of a guy who's going to become a star. Siakam has taken a very different route, and it doesn't mean he won't be the full star we think. It's just those stories are more rare. So I guess I'm more playing the odds.
I'm thinking about Daryl Morey and the Ben Simmons thing. And now, you know, yesterday, like every 2 days, there's a new thing that flares up. And now it's, you know, Dame wants to play with them, but they don't want CJ McCollum. And now Luka Doncic wants to play with them. And now Morey looks smarter and smarter for holding on. Because as other teams start to get desperate, you know, Simmons, like his stock goes up. And I think Masai is kind of doing the same thing here. I think he sees exactly what you see. But he also thinks, okay, Siakam didn't have a great year last year, or at least not, you know, where he was a couple of years ago. But, you know, you get him back in there. It's a bad team. He's going to get a ton of touches. He's going to be healthy. He's probably going to go score somewhere in the low 20s, and he's going to have, you know, he's going to have good numbers. And so his stock goes up. And this idea that you got to get rid of Scotty this year because he's going to grow, well, he's still going to be basically a really young player next year. Like, think about Ja Morant and his trajectory. Like, he came in. He was awesome, but then he was even better the next year. And now he's one of the top players in the NBA. Like, this kid's trajectory is just going to go up and up and up. I kind of think that Masai is, it's almost like he's polishing the car a little bit for resale. You know, like, Siakam's numbers are going to go up and he's going to look like a borderline all-star at his floor, I think, which is where he is now. And we're going to get a lot more for him then. Like, I think this deal is going to happen, but it's going to happen after this year when a team totally bottoms out and says, we need to rebuild.
The thing is, Bob, is that the Raptors are in a great position when it comes to this. Let's say Siakam takes that jump. Let's say, and they find a way where him and Scotty Barnes can work together. Well, great. Now you've got a 1-2 front court punch. Now, if that doesn't happen, then the next case scenario is Siakam's still going to be good, and it's going to go down the road you're talking about, and you can trade him and get back legitimate needle-moving assets because Siakam is a very good player. So I think the Raptors are in a good position either way.
You look at last night's game, and obviously there was the brutal ending. It broke everybody's heart. But what really killed the team was, one, there was a third quarter fall apart that was disastrous. But also, I went over the box score, and they had four guys who scored 19 points or more in the starting five. And the bench, I'm just doing the quick math here, they counted for about 15 points total. Like, they're just not very good. Like, they have some pretty darn good pieces in the starting front court, like in the starting five, but they don't have a lot of good players. So they're not going to do much this year. It's just not going to happen. They might squeak into a 10 seed, but I don't think there's any priority to try and make this team something it's not. And Masai has always been inclined to not rush things. You know, he doesn't seem to want to rush things now. So Siakam will be flippable for parts later. You know, you make a great point, though, about, like, maybe they do learn to play together and what an amazing front court you could have if they actually figure it out. They're both smart guys. They're both, you know, they got a ton of skills. Maybe they will figure out that chemistry. But you're right. Like, as long as everybody recognizes this is just a year to figure out what they have, then whatever happens next will be better than what it is now. It's hard to do that when you're a sports fan because you never want to lose. But I really think, like, this is a kind of a, it's like when a guy, you know, somebody comes in and they've got a new job. And it's like you got 6 months to sort of look around and figure out how it all fits. That's where we are right now. It's like, okay, let's just see where this thing goes.
No, it's a perfect situation. The Raptors are allowed to develop without having the pressure of stakes. If OG comes back and everyone's healthy, sure, Raptors could go. The Raptors could absolutely go on a run, get a play-in spot, and who knows. But if it doesn't happen, the only thing you want, because the great thing is the team is home. We don't have the stink of last year, the malaise of last year, and what's going to happen to Lowry, and Lowry's being rested and all that. You know, so at least there's a better connection between the team and the city.
And they're very likable. They're very likable, yes, too, Matt. Like, Fred is very, yes, likable. Scotty, hard not to love him. Pascal, even though there's been some bumps in the road, is a really likable player. Like, there's no reason not to feel good about this team.
Management, coach, there's no one you really don't like. The only thing you want is just to see their development. That's it. What you hope for, I mean, the bad thing going on right now is the injuries to Birch and to OG Anunoby. But that's all this year is develop, and at the end of the year, see what you have. And the worst case scenario, barring injuries, the worst case scenario is you trade Siakam for some good pieces back. That's the worst case.
All right. Do you mind if I jump off of sports for a bit? Because I have an important movie question for you.
All right. Before that, just again, a shout out. And you mentioned him before, Bob. Our lawyer is Jeff Pollock, sponsor of this podcast. If you need legal help, jeffpollock.com. That's Jeff with a G. jeffpollock.com is the best place to get him. And he's so good as our lawyer, he's calling up Bob, worried about one of his clients, me, as I was trapped in South Africa. And by the way, the funny thing is, when everyone was asking, Matt, are you safe? And I would look around and I'd have a glass of my wine or a glass of wine in my hand. And the only thing I'd say is, the only thing I'm not safe about is, will I finish this delicious ribeye steak before we have to move to our next winery?
You're the worst person in the world.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ah. All right. So big movie weekend coming up, buddy, because we're just around the corner from the release of Spider-Man No Way Home.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Scale of 1 to 10, excitement level over what you've seen so far in the trailers.
Oh, 9.5. Oh, I love it. Like, through the roof, Bob. Through the roof.
Me too. And this is the thing. Like, I'm kind of, you know, you talked about how being a fan is, like, not logical. It's passionate. And yep. I feel that way about the Marvel movies, because as much as I want to be critical of them, I just can't, because I love that they exist. This, from what I can tell, the plot of this hinges on Doctor Strange botches a spell and it opens up the multiverse. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but that seems to be what the plot hinges on. That is so hokey. You know, Spider-Man is distracting Doctor Strange in the middle of a spell. Kid, don't talk. Like, it's like the hokiest gimmick to bring on an entire movie structure, you know?
Yep.
But I just don't care. I just don't care. Because he's going to fight all those gnarly villains from the past. Like, when Alfred Molina says, "Hello, Peter,"
as Dr. Octopus. I know!
Chills. Chills!
You know what it is, Bob? It's like a superhero reunion. It's like, hey, I'm going to my 20-year high school reunion. It's like, hey, I haven't seen that guy. Dr. Octopus, how you doing? Is that, Green Goblin, have you lost weight? It's like, hey, everybody, come on. Let's have a drink at the bar.
All right, so let's do this. Let's do an unofficial power ranking here of the villains that are going to show up. Like, Alfred Molina's Doc Ock, Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin, Thomas Hayden Church's Sandman. Like, how are you ranking these?
Well, it always starts with the Green Goblin. Willem Dafoe, Green Goblin. I'm sorry, it's number one. I think there might have been a little more pathos with the Molina character, but that's going to be a very close number two. Sandman, take or leave. If you want to bring back Michael Keaton as the Vulture, big fan of that. Big fan of that, yeah, as well.
He was really good.
Yeah, and we will not speak of Jamie Foxx and Electro. Something went wrong there because he's an incredible actor. That one didn't work.
I'm actually looking forward to that character because I'm hoping with the second try they get it more right, because it should have been better than it was.
Yeah.
And I think it was just a movie that was, I don't know, it was kind of mixed up for a lot of reasons. So yeah, I'd love to see him as Electro be good. I don't think we're going to see Paul Giamatti as the Rhino, which is too bad, because that could have been a lot of fun. Who else is going to be villain? Who else is a villain in this? I'm trying to think of. Oh, the Lizard. Yeah, I didn't really care for the Lizard in those movies.
No, I didn't care about the Lizard. And by the way, Paul Giamatti as the writer, like, I'm trying to remember where there was a better actor that you totally forgot was in the film. And you know how much I love Paul Giamatti, who, by the way, great as Santa Claus and Fred Claus. But just shocking. I totally forgot about him.
So I have a Paul Giamatti story. Strombo had a TIFF party once upon a time when he was still at CBC, and there were all these stars there, and he was having a chat with Paul Giamatti, and it was one of those nights, Matt, I got lit up. I was really, really drunk. Apparently, I talked to Johnny Rotten. You know, which normally would be the kind of thing that I remember, but it was just too late in the evening for that. And I was and Strombo was talking to Paul Giamatti, and I came stumbling by, and he said, oh, here, I'd like to introduce you. And Paul started talking to me, and he was really polite and interested, and I was such a drunk doofus. Like, I actually wanted to cancel myself in the middle of, you know, when you take a look at yourself and you're like, this guy is a brilliant actor and a decent man, and he is so humoring me right now because I'm a moron. And I've always wanted to see him again just to say thank you. Thank you for being human enough to allow me the space to be the idiot that I was in that moment.
And you would add on top of that, shame on that comment about Merlot. You hurt that industry so much.
I'm pretty sure I talked to him about his dad in baseball, because his dad was Bart Giamatti, who was the commissioner of baseball.
That's right.
The much loved commissioner of baseball back in the day when people loved commissioners. Have you ever, have you ever embarrassed yourself in front of a celebrity?
I don't think so, but that's only because I haven't met that many.
Did you embarrass yourself in front of Mark Cuban?
No, no, Cuban loved me. Like I was chaperoning him by the end of the night when we met him after he was on Off the Record, and I was at multiple bars with him, and then we ended up at a stranger's place drinking whiskey at like 2-3 in the morning. No, we got along. We got along swimmingly.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, we got along really well. I think the most embarrassing, this is sad, was the only, I mentioned before, the only celebrity I gushed over was Ken Jennings from Jeopardy, because I followed his entire run on Jeopardy. So when he did the show, I was that was the only time I fanboyed.
Yeah, we used to have you interview everybody for the internet. I think, what do we call it? There was a name.
The Goods On.
The Goods On with Matt Kaws. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Great name, guys.
Yeah.
Brother. And you would always, do you remember once upon a time we had Mike Vanderjagt talk about the 10 biggest assholes in the NFL?
Oh, yeah. I remember that well. He did not hold back on his thoughts on I think Chris Carter. I remember Chris Carter.
I remember Chris Carter came up a lot.
Yeah, Chris Carter was one that came up. And
it was who called him that idiot kicker, right?
That drunken idiot. Our idiot kicker got all liquored up, or that was the comment at the Pro Bowl.
I thought about how you and I were so like innocent back then that we didn't realize that having an NFL player do a top 10 list of the biggest assholes in the league was like journalistic dynamite.
Oh, yeah. Because that was early 2000s. Like
we hadn't gotten into hot take mania yet. Like, could you imagine today having tape, like videotape of somebody in the NFL ripping other people in the NFL? Like, that would be the headline on First Take forever.
It would, on First Take, they would have to do the siren that would have been launched in London in 1942. Yeah.
Do you want to say, you know, we're almost done. There we go.
Like literally as everyone is fleeing down into the London catacombs, like that, this is not a test. Like, yeah, no, that's what, you're right. That's what it would have been back. But yeah, back then there was no 24-hour all sports. This wasn't the same.
running for the journalistic bunkers.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm done.
We're at 56 minutes in, Bob. My final thought is the trip was worth it, even with just the stress of getting home and in the quarantine hotel. And a shout out to everyone working in these hotels, these nurses and the staff. My message to the government and the consulates is, if you can find a way to give more information to the people that are trapped, to the people in hotels, people trying to get home, that's all we need. We don't need crazy special treatment. We just need more information. And to everyone out there looking to travel, when they open things up, go to South Africa. It's a beautiful, nice, safe nation. Go to Stellenbosch. It is wonderful. It was a fantastic trip. But Bob, I say this all the time, the thing that I'm most lucky about, I'm a guy that can travel and come home and be excited to go to work. And I never take that for granted.
God, it's such a beautiful way to end the episode. Can I have one more question? Did you try swordfish?
No, I didn't. I tried as many different fish as I could, but I did not try any. I did not try any swordfish. Had the biltong and everything else, but no swordfish.
Next time.
Well, Bob, I'm trying to think of that clever, classy way where we end it, and there's a joke, and then I go, goodbye, Bob, and then you go, cha-cha-cha, and all that, but I got none of that. I'll just say, Bob, it's great to be back, and to the bottom of my heart, thank you, Jeff Pollock. At least someone cared about me. Goodbye, Bob.
Bye, Matt.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom, and if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.